Jeremy Spooky, you're in the tea.
This week on Daddy Issues, we are doing a rerun of Mr. Eddie Vedder. Eddie was one of our early guests. Eddie was my favorite guest. Sorry to all the others, but it was a treat. It was an actual treat. He's so cool. So much so that he made me cry. I cried. Not able to put out an episode this week, so I'm just recording this for y'all. Because I'm in Albuquerque, New Mexico, working. And I didn't have the time, and I apologize. But enjoy Mr. Eddie Vedder. We will be back. Miss me. Miss me, miss me.
Oh, well, hell. Here we go.
Oh, well, hell.
No, oh, man. So I quit smoking like a year ago, and I had 3 cigarettes last night, and they were fantastic.
Oh, dang.
Yeah, it was there's 3 of the most amazing cigarettes that I've had, and I'm afraid that I'm going to have another one tonight, but
slip sliding away. Are you in Hawaii?
No.
No,
we're Seattle.
Oh, I know. It just looks so beautiful and bright, and I didn't think Seattle had days like that.
We get them.
Hi, buddy. That was Oliver Hudson that talked to you about having quit smoking. And just so you know, he's scared. He's nervous. He thinks you're not going to like him, and he's worried because you're too cool. And I'm trying to put him at ease, but I don't think it's working.
Yeah. Well, you know, I consider myself cool for the most part, but you're a lot cooler than I am. And so I wanted to try to at least match your cool, and I'm not sure it's going to happen, and it's okay. But even more so, Joe told me that you know my father and his band, the Hudson Brothers. I mean, no one fucking knows them. How do you even know them?
That might have been a lack of parenting. And then I must have been, stuck watching the TV on Wednesday nights at 8 o'clock, maybe Thursday.
Oh, the variety show, right?
But where did they start? What was before their own gig?
They grew up in Portland. They were born in Portland, grew up in Portland. And, you know, they've had their band since they were kids, pretty much. And they were just doing their thing. And then I think the variety show is what put them at least a little bit on the map, you know. And then my dad met my mom on an airplane and impregnated her. And that was that.
What are you, a Mile High Kid? Forget
on the
club.
Plane.
Are you a Mile High Kid? Yeah.
No, the story goes is that my mom didn't want to have anything to do with him. And he was just very persistent, you know, charming. And finally she agreed. And everything worked out. But my mom was 9 months pregnant with me when they got married. So that shows you something there.
Well, he was the most handsome of the brothers. Was he also the oldest?
Yes, he was the oldest. Middle? No, I think he was the oldest. And the most handsome. And he also bailed on me, so
I'll take Hudson Brothers trivia for $500, Alex.
Well, what's how did that?
No,
last?
But we're in a different, we're in a better place now. But man, I didn't. It was a rough go for a long, long time, and only in the last year or so we've reconnected just through text. But you know, he lives in Malibu and has forever, and I just never saw him. And you know, he was doing his own thing. He had his other family, plural, I guess, families, and he just sits in his studio, and he's been trying to write an album for 150 years. Drinks his whiskey, smokes his joints, and he's just emotionally, you know, not necessarily at a place where we can truly, truly connect, but we've had a few six packs and we've had some really nice times over the last couple of years. And we're content in a way that it's something rather than just nothing, you know, but that's the way it is.
You know, for somebody who grew up you know, when I, by the time I found out who my dad was, he was no longer on the planet. So, you know, that's, there's a lot that, that, that contentment, that's a big deal. It's very,
yeah,
that's worth a lot. Whatever it is, it's worth a lot, you know?
Yeah, no, I think you're right. And I think about that. And I was just talking with my, actually my sister's boyfriend yesterday about it, you know, when he dies, how am I going to feel about it if I have not at least made my best effort, even though he was the one and responsible for being the dad in my life. And he was not able to do that. I have forgiven him entirely because the truth is that his dad left him when he was 5 years old, never to return until the boy's mid-20s. So he didn't have much of a chance, you know, and at that time, there was not a lot of therapy and it wasn't about looking inward and trying to resolve your, you know, some psychological patterns that you've developed. For me, it was a little different. I didn't want to be that dad. You know, I really made a point to, I'm going to be all in with my kids. So I forgive him. He didn't have much of a shot necessarily. And after I have that sort of sense of forgiveness, you know, I was thinking, oh man, I got to connect with this guy because if he dies, how am I going to feel about it? You know, at the end of the day, he is my dad. So mortality did play a factor in me wanting to get back together with him and at least reconnect, you know?
You know, there's a great, that Soul Cages record that Sting put out in the early 90s or something. He addresses his father passing away and some, it's a great collection of songs. And one of them is Why Should I Cry For You? And it's, there's some powerful stuff in it. I've listened to that record quite a bit, not even knowing. You know, the interesting thing about my pop was that, you know, when I found out the, you know, who he was and would learn a bit about him from, you know, his sisters or my mom or my uncles or family members, that, cause it was kind of like a secret. When the secret was out, then they could kind of, share with me, you know, who this guy was and how he was. And, you know, he was a musician and a singer and a, rode horse, you know, he had some cool stuff going on. And he was by no means perfect either. And he died of MS in the early 80s, I believe. And, you know, to the fact that he, so I have this like image, this father, this kind of, I would say like this spiritual energy up there somewhere where I could feel he would, you know, look after me, or sometimes I'd feel him playing certain songs or certain places, and I'd feel like his energy, like I think he's watching his kid right now, you know. But what I was gonna say about it is, you know, he had he lived and had we got a relationship, and you know, who knows what where his trajectory was headed. But what I was gonna say is he could have turned into a complete knucklehead. You know, he could have been an asshole drunk who tried to pick up on groupies backstage, like, you know, who knows. So in a weird way he died young enough to not have fucked me over personally. So he kind of has a, he gets to be a little bit on the a pedestal, which I'm happy for him for that.
Yeah.
Do you know if your dad was a writer? Because I of all that you possess, Ed, I think your writing, whether it's your music, just if you're writing a piece or something that you just want to get out there, even a text. I mean, you're so thoughtful, and the way that you compose things. I mean, that was your mom that way? Is your mom that way? What was your dad the kind of guy that was good with the written word or putting things together? Do you have any idea about that?
Well, I guess what I'd base that, the answer to that on would be some of the recordings that I've found. And you know what? There's not an original in there. If he wrote stuff, and then I got some manuscript music printed out that he had written out. You know, he would play in clubs and a little bit of a crooner type, but it was always kind of cover song. So he wasn't a writer, as far as I know. He was a rider as far as horses, but not a writer. And my mom was a reader. You know, she instilled that into me pretty heavy. And I grew up in the Chicago school systems in the early 70s. So I had a pretty good education there. Before I moved to, when we moved to California, I think I was in fourth grade. And I think I was in eighth grade reading. And the interesting thing about that is by the time I was a sophomore in high school in California, I was dumb as everybody else.
They caught up.
I figured out how to kind of cruise, you know, and our high school was close enough where you could see if the waves were breaking at lunchtime. Whatever class I ended up having, fifth or sixth period, I never made it to those very often. But
I mean, for you, Ed, I just know you. We met as older men. I mean, I think the one common thread you and I had when we ran into each other when I first met you and that
wait was
going
it
off the elevator.
It was that recent. I thought we met a while
exactly.
Back.
You know, you know what I mean. Yeah, okay, we were dads by then, and I think about you know what connected us was your love of baseball and the fact that you're a father to two girls. I'm a father to two girls now, two girls and two more boys, but you are not at all what I thought you would be, seeing you from the outside and then getting to know you. I know you as one of the most thoughtful, engaged friends, parents. You're a special person. You remember everything. You're highly intelligent. I don't believe you that you were as dumb as everybody else. I feel like you were always a little bit wiser than everybody else. How would you describe yourself?
Well, these are very nice things to hear. Did you hear that? Is there some diagnosis? Have I been diagnosed with something?
Shut up. Just answer the yes. question. Shut up.
Yes. Just tell him, Joe. Just tell him.
No,
I love being around you. I love your energy. I love talking to you on the phone. You listen. You're a great listener. Maybe that's what I'm getting at. Like, you care genuinely about people. And I'm wondering if you know where that comes from.
If that's true, then I guess it would be going back to that writing thing, because I think to write, you need to observe. And, you know, that was the one weird thing when the band got kind of recognized to a level that your energy... It got a little harder to be an observer because you were being observed. So that was, I remember
that's
feeling cool. That happen. And that was strange, but, I guess maybe it comes from something of that ilk, but I also think, you know, part of your question is what would be like a misnomer or some kind of, and that would be the last thing that I would ever try to think about is what other people think about me. I that might've been another thing that happened early on when we were playing and getting this strange amount of attention, was at that point, maybe you were thinking like, what do people think? Like what? And then trying to kind of be something that maybe they wanted, either they wanted you to be or something you wanted them to think you are. but it wasn't actually you. And I think it wasn't really until like Into the Wild, I started touring solo. And I remember having like a month to kind of get this thing ready, like, you know, play beautiful theaters, 2,000 seats, and tour, and the gigs are booked. And then maybe something happened in life, and then all of a sudden rehearsal got, your practice got cut to 2 weeks. And I kept thinking there'd be a, like a person, since it was just going to be me up there, there'd be like a DJ personality that I'd come up with, or some kind of like protection, you know, something. And I kept thinking I would kind of come up with this almost like an act that would happen and kind of galvanize the performance in some kind of way, or deliver it in some kind of way that I thought it would be good to construct something. And in the end, I just ran out of time, and it was time to go. And I just walked out that night and just gave it what I got, which was just me. And it was in Canada, I think it was in Vancouver. And I just played two small shows in Seattle, like warm-up gigs. This little room down the street, 100 people, $5, 100 people, 10 rows of 10 people. And it was terrible. I made a bunch of mistakes. I mean, people were too close, you know. My neighbors came to the show, and they sat right directly in front of me, about 4 feet from my foot. and they said after, they said, you know, it's interesting. You don't really look at people in the crowd. You don't look out. And I thought, well, that's because it was you. You were right fucking in front of me. I'm sorry, Mark and Carol. I love you. But it was just kind of, it was just a little strange. Because we're neighbors. We're friends. We hang. But yeah, that was the thing. And then, you know, one other great bit of just, would have never predicted it, was, you know, and this is why it's good to kind of be in tune or be lucky enough to be paying attention. But we had a night off before leaving the next day, and Bruce Springsteen was playing in Seattle. And we, after sound check, we were hanging out in his room, and I think I gave him a ukulele. He's playing ukulele. We're having a talk. Bruce Springsteen has said he'd never really had an ukulele, and yet he's playing it perfect and talking the whole time. 45 minutes, maybe an hour and a half, I can't remember. But he said, "What are you doing?" I said, "Well, I'm playing, starting these solo gigs tomorrow, actually." And he says, "Wow, that's crazy." He said, "Just you?" I said, "Yeah, just me, you know, a few instruments different, you know, I'm trying to change the dynamics by playing, you know, ukulele, guitar, electric guitar, you know, organ." I can't remember if I was using that at the time, but just kind of sonically keep the dynamics going. And but he said, "Just you." And I said, "Yep." He said, "That's good." He gave me this one gem of advice, which just changed everything. And he said, as I was saying, I was making mistakes and those first couple little mini gigs. He said, "You know, there's a real power when there's just one person up there. There's like it's terrifying for the audience, even, you know, it's a tight wire act. And there's just something that there's an intimacy in it, and there's a power in it." And that, it was just one of the greatest things to hear, because all of a sudden you didn't feel as vulnerable. It gave you something. It gave you a gear. It gave you something substantial to even just imagine or put into place. You know, it'd be like you know, getting great hitting advice from Ted Williams or something. It just gave you something. And then there you go. That was, but I definitely needed that. I needed that. I didn't know what it was. But
Do you care what people think about you just in general, you know, or do you, cause my dad, Kurt, you know, my stepdad, the one thing that I envy most about him is he just doesn't give a shit what people think, you know, and it's so liberating. And I don't have that, you know, I that's part of my process is not worrying so much about the perception of me, you know. I can't control how people are going to think or feel. All I can control is myself. Kurt has this incredible ability to not give a fuck about what people think, and it just frees him up in his art. You know, do you care what people think about you?
I mean, I certainly care what people think about politics. I certainly care about what people think about other people. I don't know when it changed, but as far as caring what they think about me, I just don't. I don't have the bandwidth for it. It seems like it would hinder, you know, I want them to think that I'm playing well. I like to want them to feel a connection when we do, but, you know, and people will say really nice things to you. Not as nice as Joe has said today, but you know, they say nice things about what your music has meant to them, and it's really powerful, and I take it all in. But it's so it's nice to hear good things. But if someone were to, you know, I think if it's someone really close to me and they had some either constructive criticism or they were just pissed off or what, I would want to know, and I would care. But as far as anything outside the close circle of what someone who doesn't actually know me, what they would think, I would not ever want to care. And it wasn't always that way. I can't remember when that changed. I think it was just kind of age and experience and maybe, I think maybe some accomplishments, you know, I think maybe just having some, you know, accomplishments under my belt made me feel like, well, now I don't have to give a fuck anymore.
Oh yeah. Success obviously allows you to be that way to some degree, but I do know you as I've mentioned before, this great dad, and this whole quarantine time has allowed us all to hit the pause button as awful as it's been for so many people, and people have battled this virus on top of that. I think this time out has, you know, it's brought me closer to my girls. It's brought my girls closer to their new brothers. And I wonder, you know, what the silver linings have been for you and Jill and the girls as everybody has just kind of gone into time out here.
Well, all that being said about me being a good dad, they have a great, great mom. So, and I think what's been good about this is being able to co-parent a little closer and not fall into some of the other patterns that we might have gotten into, for better or worse, but just to get through and do the best job you can as a couple, and as parents, you might do a good cop, bad cop thing, and then I might end up being the good cop more often than, you know, patterns, right? And I think that, I think just kind of having it be more immediate and consistent and linear and intense and riding the waves together, you know, like tandem surfing, it's been a little, it's been different in a good way on that. And I hope these are lessons that we can maintain, and if things return back to some of the old schedules of me being gone for bits here and there, that we can maintain all that and keep it as part of our process. But, you know, like Father's Day, I got three cards independent of each other that said, you know, this quarantine thing has sucked, but it's been really great having you around. And I didn't even know that they missed me that much. So that was, that was really powerful stuff. And, you know, who knew that was actually the presence made the heart grow fonder. That was, I always felt that, you know, going away, you know, month at a time, you know, and Joe, you know how it is. I don't know how much you travel, Oliver, but, you know, it was, I thought we worked it pretty good where, you know, I'd be gone and then they'd appreciate when I was back home. But I think all the tricky thing was always the re-entry, you know, re-entry always took a little bit. And then also preparing to leave again takes a little bit. So if you're a month on, month off, there's really only that 2 week period in the middle that feels like you're really, you know, as a family kind of galvanized. And now we've had, 4 or 5 months and much more to come. So it's, that would be that silver lining you were talking about.
Did you feel like it was a sacrifice though, that you were making? Meaning, of course it was your music and it's what you love and it's your heart, but you knew that you had to be away from your family and your kids. I mean, did you feel like you were making a sacrifice in a way?
To go out and play?
One or the other, yeah.
To go out and play? Yeah. Well, I wouldn't, if I felt like it was a sacrifice or the family was being sacrificed, I wouldn't do it.
Yeah.
So okay. I think that, you know, we're lucky compared to athletes or especially baseball players that have these schedules that they, 162 games and 28 days off or something crazy. What is it, Joe?
Yeah. Insane. I mean, that's basically it. Yeah. It's a lot. I think all three of us on this call feel the same way because Ollie, I've heard you say you've not taken jobs because you knew it would take you away from your family for long 100%. Stretches of time. Yeah. And Eddie, you don't really have that luxury at times. You have to go promote a record. You have to go on tour. You have to do your thing. And, you know, I would imagine at some point you were taking them along with you, but what you just said hit home with me because the re-entry is hard. And then by the time that settles into a new norm or you get into a comfortable feeling, now you're just preparing to leave again. And so, like you said, presence made the heart grow fonder. And, you know, I'm finding the same thing over these last few months.
Well, part of me, sorry to interrupt, Joe, but part of the reason why I'm such like a hyper dad, almost to, I think, a fault in a way, I sometimes attach my own emotions and feelings to the way my kids are feeling, and I can't detach from that. And I've had issues with that, especially early on in having kid when I was having with my firstborn, especially. But no, for me, because my dad wasn't around, I felt like if I was not there, even for a week or two, it would be to the detriment of my children, which is not true. That was my own psychology. That was my own shit that I was dealing with. But it was very prevalent, especially early on as a dad, you know. I don't feel it as much now, but that was big for me. It would hurt me, you know, it would hurt me to be away for 2 weeks. I would feel like I'm fucking them up, you know?
Well, I think also, and again, if you can be fairly in control, you know, and with band tours, you know, we kind of work with everybody's families and everybody's demands as, you know, fathers, to create a schedule that everybody kind of agrees on. Okay, we're taking this on, and it's not just, you know, can the band guys take it? Can our families take it on? And so we're able to do that. But I think, you know, as long as you're paying attention and being, you know, hyper aware of it, even, you know, and knowing that it's not just also you're making a living, and making it nice and college in the future and you know, all these things. There's also the thing about like, it's our special purpose. That's what, it's kind of a thing that makes us in some ways who we are. And, you know, and then, you know, mom has a special purpose and the kids have their special purpose, you know, that we all kind of are aware and work so everybody has that space to be their best selves, you know, which mm-hmm. That's going to come from, you know, accomplishments and, you know, being part of, you know, movements and helping people. And so it's, you know, it's a balance. So, but carving that space to be able to be who you are in the family construct is, I think, so important.
Do you know that you just referenced the movie The Jerk? Wasn't that from The Jerk?
Oh,
Mom, I found what my special purpose is. Oh, baby, you'll find what your special purpose is.
Yeah, that was.
Don't try to get subtle bullshit in here. I know what you're referencing.
You got me on that. Yeah.
Our special purpose.
Did you always want to be a dad, or was that something that just, you know what I mean? Like, did it just happen?
Well, there was some romance involved, mm-hmm. and still is, but, that's the good news. But, I would, when I think that how grateful I am to, have these daughters in my life, I can be grateful to their mama. 'Cause you know, I think she was the one that would be willing to commit before I would be, mainly because again, I was really wrapped up in my special purpose in writing and recording and playing live, you know? So that, you know, that's one thing, you know, I think as far as being a parent or me in particular, or somebody who's of that artistic bent, it's a little bit of a curse and you're, you know, kind of always have a song in your head or always, or witnessing the world or reading the paper or hearing a story or hearing somebody behind you, in a restaurant and just wanting to write. And I remember being on the floor with the kids, you know, playing a game, but I was really, I mean, with Chutes and Ladders, it's fucking mindless. So of course I could write a song in my head while I'm playing Chutes and Ladders.
Or that's Candy, the title of the Candy song, Land. By the way. Yeah.
But yeah, by the way, you should not much rhymes with Candyland. Or
yeah, but Chutes and Ladders should be a title track of a song of yours for sure. Chutes, it just sounds good. Chutes and Ladders.
You know what? I remember hanging, there was a few summer, well, it was a while back, maybe 15 years ago now, and the summer, my friend Chris Chelios and Laird Hamilton and John McEnroe, they, I can't remember who the other, you know, they're extremely competitive experts at what they do but extremely competitive. John McEnroe, Laird Hamilton. Oh, yeah. I mean, these are extremely competitive. And I thought if I could just get everyone to throw in, you know, like $2,500. So there was, you know, 10 grand on the line and then just watch him play Chutes and Ladders.
You can't be serious.
Takes no, there's nothing roll. You can do but turn the cards. Yeah. And I just thought that would be just fascinating. I never got around
I
to
love
it.
That idea.
Somewhere, I would be scared McEnroe would flip the game board over and nobody would remember where they were. And then they'd have to call the bet off. Mm-hmm. I've always heard my whole life that rock stars or actors want to be athletes, and then the reverse is true. You, Ed, from what I know, and I mean, I know plenty. Would you cash it all in if you could play one game as a real Chicago Cub? If you could
just one game.
I'm talking about your career, nothing else. Just Pearl Jam, Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. You get four at bats in a real daytime game at Wrigley Field, and that's it. You get one. That's all. Would you
at least give him the World Series? At least give him the World Series.
All right.
Nope. I want a Tuesday in May.
Listen, there's no fucking way ever. But unless it was a World Series game, a game seven.
Yeah.
And if you won it and with a walk-off grand slam in the 12th, you know, if that one game could have been like my David Ross game, game seven, Chicago Cubs, they've never won it, then maybe, but still, no.
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 Well, let's just take it a step further. The success that you have in the music world, if you could have the same success as a Cub, would you switch that?
No, the to me, as much as baseball is and Wrigley Field and Chicago Cubs, and I mean it's really important to me, like a limb that I'm fond of and use often. Like it's extremely, it's been an important part of my life and a great dedication, and I've experienced such incredible, and they have so many great friendships through it and experiences. And
where did that come from, by the way, Ed? Like where did that passion for the Cubs and sports come from?
Well, let me go back and just say about the music thing though, just to clarify that it's just, you know, the element, and I've talked about it before, but the art, well, art form, I mean, you know, whatever. You have volume, you have velocity, you have, you know, some lyrical content, you have the physicality of playing, and then when you have an audience, and we've been so fortunate, but an energetic audience, and they're feeding you, or you give them something, and then they give it back, and then it just keeps heightening and raising up, and then there's a element of improvisation, and you can move it, and you're communicating with your band members, and you're exploring things live, you know, that are happening in the moment, and I mean, all that stuff. You just can't beat it on any, whether I'm watching a band or especially being able to be fortunate enough to be the kind of nucleus to that. Well, you know, the other thing that is part of that live experience is that, you know, and we're blessed with these larger size crowds, you know, is there's an energy to a large group of people. There's a real incredible energy just due to the fact that you're witnessing tens of thousands of people agreeing on something.
Yes.
Great. Oh, that's so well put. I love that. Yeah.
Just to see them singing along, dancing within the same kind of wave and agreeing on something, you know, like six people trying to order a pizza. That's hard. You know, so 10,000, 20,000, Brazil, South America, you're playing 100,000 people, you know, as far as the eye can see, and then some, and you can see the waves of, you know, the drum beat, you can see the sound travel as they clap hands. Like, it's just incredible. You can actually see the sound wave in the people clapping, like the Queen at Wembley Stadium for Live Aid. You could actually see the sound wave. That's just an incredible thing to witness at a time when we really are being tested on the lesson of, look, if it affects one person, it affects all of us. If it affects a certain community, it affects all of us. If it affects, you know, you know, all our different, the things that kind of bond us, but we each have, you know, our kind of separate either communities or sexual orientations or, but if it's not, you know, if we're not all healthy and surviving, then we're all at risk. And this, the pandemic is really put that in our faces, that in a way that I don't think the modern world has ever experienced. Obviously not. It's,
yeah. And I think that's the part, the isolation, you know, the divisiveness. And I, you're right. I think about that when people ask me now about sports. I'm like, look, I'm smart enough to know that not everybody's a sports fan. But at a time like this, we need something to bring people together. Your band brings people together. You bring people together. Sports, these communal activities that bring people from different races together, as you said, sexual orientations together, from different political beliefs together, giving high fives to people in the stands or singing as one to your music. I mean, that's what's needed now more than ever. And that's the heartbreaking part of this whole thing, is shelter in place means you're on your own, and you're not really, you can't even smile at somebody from behind a mask. The most simple, you're walking down an aisle in a grocery store, or you're, you know, I try to be as friendly as I can to everybody I see. And just to flash somebody a smile in these days is so vitally important. And yet we're all wearing masks, so nobody can even see that. So it's like an Orwellian, like, weird kind of,
Joe, you got to learn to smile with your eyes, Joe. It's a practice.
I've noticed that. I've noticed I've been given a lot of thumbs up, like in the grocery store, like thumbs. I feel like Ronnie Wood walking through the backstage, like, hey, thumbs up. Or there was
Simon Cowell does that a lot on America's Got Talent. Like, I love you. Here's my thumbs up. That's fine. That's what I'm going to do.
I'm still going to keep smiling, doing it. I'm still, even though you said okay, that, I'm still going to.
There was Phil Mickelson.
Yeah, hey, I'm thumbs up. okay, fine.
There was a woman walking out of Target the other day. My daughter and I were walking in, and she had a young daughter with her, this cool African-American woman. And her shirt, just black shirt with big white writing, just said, "Stop fucking killing us." And, you know, I nodded, but then realized, like, she can't, you know, and I'm not close enough to see the eyes, because again, we're keeping 6 feet apart. But man, double thumbs up on that one. That was.
I've even gone to the point where I will take my mask off after I pass at a safe distance and go, "Hey, I was smiling," or, you know, in your case, "Love the shirt. I'm with you." You know,
or they don't yeah, smile back, and then you're like, "Hey, I was smiling, asshole."
Right, exactly. I do that, you know, in olden times, like, you know, last winter. if I smile or say something and they don't smile back, I'm like, "Can I get that smile back, please? Fuck you. I'm smiling. I don't know you. I just gave you a smile out of nowhere and you didn't smile back. I want it back."
Come on, Joe. They're free. Keep giving them out. Can I say one more thing about sports, Joe? Is that you said that about sports and having people have a reason to come together, and then keep from being isolated, and I really hope that's what happens, because if it were to be just a distraction, that part would make me nervous. If it's just a people looking for a distraction or some respite from, you know, all this insanity, I understand, and I feel the need for it. Totally understand and agree. But I'm really hoping that the issues can stay at the forefront.
How do we keep the momentum? You know, how do we keep that at the forefront?
I think just staying engaged, like an athlete working out every day. You know, it's like our job, right? It's our job. And, you know, we need to do it not just for ourselves. We're doing it for everybody. You know, it's just one of those times. And that's a powerful thing. Like, we get to be at bat, this generation, or these two generations are coming up on that are alive now, three generations. It's it's World Series. It's on. And our, you know, what we're up against, you know, the opposing team is, you know, the destruction of our planet. So I think just staying engaged and understanding, and don't let this, you know, distractions, meaning misinformation or, you know, and being a little bit media savvy, you know, teaching our kids to be media savvy, you know, read the whole thing and then find out what the headline means, and then find another source, you know, make sure you're not just, and also not in an echo chamber of only people who are like-minded, and, you know, you're getting your news feed on a, you know, our little echo chamber machines that are in our pockets 24/7 and next to our beds at night, you know? Mm-hmm. So I think really becoming a little bit more media savvy would be a very helpful thing. And, you know, I'm not sure how people communicate, you know, with Instagrams and TikToks and Facebooks, and, but I for all the positives there are, I think there are equal, if not more, negatives if you're not careful. And that's a guy, or you know, we're parents of two, you know, young women that are very vulnerable in that kind of atmosphere. So it's a lot to be conscious of.
How do you deal with that with your girls, actually? You know what I mean? Like, do you just put your faith in them and trust them? Or is there, to navigate?
No, they have to be monitored and know that they're being monitored. And they get upset quite often when, you know, we have to take it away. You know, mm-hmm. you can kind of, you know, it would be like, I think it chemically it affects their mood, it affects their actions, it affects their kind of physical being, kind of going down the rabbit holes of technology. And there's some, we've had some huge laughs and enjoyment out of, you know, some kind of TikTok thing and whatever, but at the same time, I know that we had probably had like Atari when I was a kid, some kind of gaming system, Pong or something that
Pong, dude, I loved Pong
indoors, like, you know, like we were out riding bikes.
I mean, we're out riding bikes. We were playing football on the front lawn or whatever we were doing. But I mean, I hope
you got to strike that balance, man. It's about balance. I got three kids and I deal with the same shit right now. My older boys are sort of getting into more technology. And look, I can't just deny it altogether, but I need to be the one to find the balance for them, because I don't want them to stay inside all day. That's why I'm in Colorado right now. That's why we've moved to Colorado at times in our lives. Cause I'm like, get on your dirt bikes, ride your motorcycles, go on your mountain bikes. Let's go fish. Let's go do this. And if they can have that balance, then I feel, in my opinion, they can be well-rounded, you know, but I've also got a boy who's going through puberty right now. Shit is changing. You know, things are developing. The girls are coming into the picture. You know, there's some inappropriate shit that's going on. But at the same time, I'm thinking about, oh, man, when I was 12, where was I? I don't want to be hypocritical. I go through, I sort of cycle through these questions.
Man, don't put them on your scale. Jesus Christ. Do the world a favor. God, don't say back when I was 13. No. Have a higher standard for your own kid. You fucker.
Well, I was. I know. I should. Because I was. Yeah, I was. I was a little early. I was a little early.
He was a little bit early. I'll tell you some stories later, Eddie. You'll blow your mind. Even you.
Oliver. You were rolling that Cheech and Chong album that came with the two foot rolling paper.
Totally.
You probably stole an ounce of your dear dad. Well, I don't know if it was Bill. His pot.
No, it was Alex Kasson's dad.
A 2 foot joint with stolen weed.
Right. Then you throw some hookers. Throw some hookers in there when he was about 15. Now 16. You're starting to get 16. Now you're starting to get
picture. But let's be clear for a second, because we got to put this into context. I wasn't paying for a hooker. I had a relationship with a high class escort at the age of 16, and she was 26. And I want to create a TV show around this, because it was a time in my life in the 90s in Los Angeles that was informed everything that I am today in the best possible way, honestly. There was a lot
except for that persistent drip.
No, everything. I took penicillin. Crap. I took penicillin.
And the clap. And the, yeah. I'm not passing joke.
Were we just talking about like climate change and how to fix the world? Yeah.
Yes. Yes, exactly. We were.
And you got a 16-year-old with a high class escort. That's what you're dealing with on the other side of Zoom here.
Joe, you took us here. You took us there. You know, we were being very articulate and thoughtful, and you know, you took us down Heidi Fleiss escort situation.
Uh-huh. God.
But I just wanted to be clear that this is not a 16-year-old, you know, I'm paying for a high-class fucking hooker. This is a situation that I got into, you know, where I was having a relationship with
Clear. We got it. We got
okay.
the picture.
Okay, I just want to be clear.
You're clear.
And what was your job at 16? What were you, what was your occupation?
Well, I was doing him?
No, Oliver. Yeah.
No, I got expelled from high school because I cheated on a chemistry test, which was fucking bullshit. That's a whole other story. And I met this woman who was an assistant, and it's a long story, but she turned out to be, you know, this high class escort. But she was very beautiful, and she went to Columbia, graduated Columbia, and spoke French and German, and was incredibly beautiful. And I was at her apartment, you know, on Martell and Melrose, and I sat on her bed early on, and $2,000 fell out of her purse. And I said, "What is that?" And she says, "Oh, it's nothing. I owe it to a friend." And I said, I don't believe you. And she said, "Do you know what's going on in the news right now with Heidi Fleiss?" And I said, "Yes, I do." And she said, "Well, I'm one of her girls." And I was like, "Okay." And then that started about an 8 to 10 month relationship with her, and I brought all my young friends into the mix, and it was a big crazy party.
This is the script of Risky Business. I've seen this.
No, well, I'm creating.
And then she stole your Fabergé egg, and then you had to use the money to get it back before your parents came home.
I am developing a show around this part of my life, because honestly, if we want to get into it just for a second, it was less about being salacious and you know, just fucking a bunch of, you know, beautiful people at the age of 16. It was, she was truly in love with me, and she was scared and didn't know how to deal with it. And I was she was my sexual awakening. You know, 5 months before, I had just lost my virginity. So she was my
Eddie's
second
been off the
partner.
Call for 3 minutes. Eddie's been
I know,
gone.
Sorry.
This reminds me of the time.
We can talk about this story later, I
land
guess.
The plane. This reminds me of a time when we were hanging out at Murphy's after a Cubs game in 2016, and Eddie's playing guitar, and I'm the one singing in front of a nice little room of people. And I said, "How mad are you people right now?" It's like 2 a.m. that I'm the one singing and he's not. And we've got Eddie Vedder on our podcast, and we're listening to, you know, My Tutor Part 2 with starring Oliver Hudson.
Well,
that's your special purpose.
It was a fascinating time in my life.
God. Unbelievable. Who, Eddie, were your male father figures once you got into music? Was it Petty? Was it Neil Young? Who did you look to for guidance when you were a younger guy making your way in the world today? Takes everything you got.
Well, it certainly was. It came from music, and I would say Pete Townsend, because you know, an album like Quadrophenia, it was actually like it wasn't the first record by any means that I had gotten by them, and then it comes out. I don't think I got it the day it came out. I think it came out in I can't remember the exact years, but that just seemed to address exactly what I was going through. And I know I'm not alone. There's so many people that record was a huge lifeline for them. And it always astounded me that this father, well, it wasn't a father figure. It was just, I couldn't believe that somebody from, you know, a whole nother country, which, you know, when I was a kid and kind of small beginnings, like, you know, Europe or something seemed as far away and distant as, you know, Jupiter or something. Like, it was so unattainable. I just always marveled at how closely things resonated. And, you know, that's one thing about Pete Townsend lyrics, and Bruce, and, you know, there's so many, or, you know, Johnny Lydon, Joe Strummer, Michael Stipe, you know, all these great writers.
Do you write with that in mind, thinking that you could be doing the very same thing for somebody? You just write what you write.
No, that would be too heavy. That'd be way too heavy. You try to get the best out of you that you can. That's for sure. And I think I could be a harsh critic. You know, lyrics aren't done until they're done.
Yeah.
But but yeah, all those lyrics. You know, what's interesting about them is you hear them as a kid and have a certain relationship to them, and then as you get older, if the lyrics such a great lyric or strong one, then as you get older, and maybe the age of what they were when they wrote it. You know, there's some songs off Who by Numbers, all of a sudden they have whole new meanings. And but yet the song was so multifaceted and delivered the goods on the lyrical content that they're kind of timeless, and they affect you in different ways at different times. I mean, that's a real remarkable thing. And then, of course, you know, having a relationship of, you know, years later to have the craziest blessing to have these people in your life as friends and confidants and supporters, and it's just been one of life's greatest thrills, you know, greatest fortunes. And I've been texting with Bruce a lot. He says to say hi to you, Joe. we've been listening, Bruce and I have been listening to, I think it's okay that I say it, we've been listening to all the World Series since 2016, after the Cubs were in 17, 18, 19, every year we've listened to, or we've watched the games together. Bruce and I, we text, and then we talk about Joe, and then I'm texting Joe, and then we're...
They have actually texted me words, Ollie, during a game to say. So I know on the other end somewhere, Bruce Springsteen, McEnroe the same, and then Vedder, and I'm doing the World Series. I'm waiting for the quid pro quo here where I can text him something on stage and he can, you know, give me a little...
Yeah.
Shout out.
Oh, I can do
in
that.
A subtle way. I do that with you. Know.
I do that with you too. So look, I'm not the status of Bruce and Eddie, but you know, let's include me in that. I definitely text you things to say.
It's a long list.
I want to be known. But I wanted to touch on one quick thing, because you were talking about sort of timeless lyrics. Is there anyone now, current, more contemporary, that is writing music, writing lyrics that will in 25, 30, 50 years be timeless? You know, I mean, is there anyone that you are feeling that has that kind of talent or that kind of heart?
Well, I think the lyric, they haven't played in quite a while, but some of the greatest records ever made are by a band called Fugazi. And then the lyricist, Ian Mackay, who now has a band called The Evens. And it just incredible. That'll be the stuff for me that will always be timeless. And I think Jack White, the last Raconteurs record, everything he's put out, he's already a legend. It's not like a new guy on the scene by any means, but he's just been he's a powerful force, man. He's really everything you could want out of a musician and a human being. And he has his own back company, which also makes surfboards. I mean, it just can't get any better.
Wow.
And is a former concessionaire at Tiger Stadium.
See?
Which really?
Yeah. Jack White. I met him at a Tigers game, and he used to be at old Tiger Stadium. A wonderful guy. As we wrap up, and then we can all get back to our lives, you referenced Steve Gleason earlier, and I cannot watch that interview you guys did with him that I think was on ESPN without bawling my eyes out. And you're really vulnerable, Ed, in that interview. And you know, if there's ever a time to be, you know, that's it. Because you're looking at somebody who's has more courage than all of us combined and has been through more than any of us can fathom. And yet he keeps getting out there swinging, making a difference. And you talked about your dad, Eddie, and you said, you know, first and foremost, I would just like to know that he loved me. And I cannot hear you say that on a taped interview without it hitting me so deep. And I'm wondering, as I've gotten to know you over the years, with your heart and your depth and your soul, you know, do you still think of that? Are you in some way still creating this life that would make him so proud that, I mean, there would be nothing but love that he could have for this boy that he created that has meant so much to so many people. Is that a part of you still to this day? Do you think, does that ghost sit out there for you?
Well, you're very nice to say those things. I feel it more. I don't think that'll ever go away, but I feel it more in my wife and my kids now. I want them to be proud of their dad and part of their husband, her husband. And so that's way bigger now, you know. that's the living legacy, you know. That would be the one that I would care about most. Oh, you know what I was gonna tell you? Did I tell you, Joe, I was working on a Sean Penn movie during this downtime.
I wasn't going to bring up stuff that I don't want to bring up anything that I'm not supposed to bring up. So I've just been laying low.
Well, actually right before the call, because they're kind of putting the finishing touches on it now. And I don't think it's been talked about out there, but I asked John if I could mention it and he said, hell yeah. So there's this cool film that he's made. I mean, it's unbelievable, actually. And in a way, I think there's bits of Into the Wild in there, but it's a female story. You know, it's a young woman based on a true story. There was a book called Flim Flam Man that is now a movie called Flag Day. And Sean and Robin's daughter, Dylan, is in it. And she's just incredible. Sean directed it and plays the dad. It's really kind of her amazing journey, but then the relationship between the dad who's not he ain't Ward Cleaver, And but it's really, really intense and so powerful. But I got the opportunity to add some music in it, and Glenn Hansard as well, and Sean Marshall, Cat Power. So that's been a one kind of work thing that we've been able to kind of get from the past conception into delivery soon, I think. It's just so proud of Sean and his crew, and just blown away by his kids. His son Hopper plays the brother too. It's really powerful. But yeah, and I'm not sure when it'll come out or anything like that or how, but
they shot it. Everything was shot though prior to
everything was shot right when they were kind of in getting into final editing, or that, you know, that kind of last run around the track, right when it all this stuff went down. In fact, Glenn Hansard was in Los Angeles, flew from Ireland to Los Angeles. I had one meeting with Sean Penn and Sean Marshall, and they were going to be in the studio for 2 weeks or so, and then literally had to turn around that evening and get back to Ireland because they were closing the borders. Mm. So, and then after that, it was kind of put on hold, and we started working from home and different way to do things. But
the most important part of that whole project to me is the next layer, which you can choose to talk about or not.
Which is?
Who you may or may not have collaborated with on one of the songs.
Oh, yeah,
we can cut this all out, so it doesn't matter.
Yeah. Well,
you don't have to say it. If you
yeah,
don't
want to I'm gonna,
it.
I'm gonna unwrap that present later.
Okay. All right.
Well, I like it better like this, because now you can leave that in, and have everyone wondering.
Yes. Yes.
Well, it was.
It's him.
It was an important collaboration.
John Davidson. It's you and John Davidson, right?
John Davidson, who wrote an incredible book that all my success, I can kind of dedicate it back to our producer, Brendan O'Brien, who we made many, many, many records with. And he turned me onto a book by John Davidson called The Singing Entertainer. I don't think you can find a copy of it on eBay. They're so valuable. And it will teach you everything. How to stand, how to hold your mic, where to position the people in your staff during a staff meeting, you know, a pre-tour meeting. There's certain people that should sit in certain places. And it
like your neighbor 4 feet away from your feet. Or does it talk about you hanging off rafters? Did John Davidson ever hang from rafters at different music festivals? Was that part of the book?
No. Well, that would be my take on it. Yeah. But see, that was something that Lola Falana never did, you see. So it was kind of pre. Well, it's funny to think that was going on. You know, your Lola Falanas and your Engelbert Humperdincks. That was going on at the same time as punk rock.
Yeah. Which is kind of your first love, is it not? Punk guy at heart.
Punk rock or Engelbert?
Engelbert Humper Snatch.
No, but okay. So here's our, here's where we can segue here. This cool thing happened to me about dads and getting to know my dad. And there's a crazy Cubs connection. And Oliver, you were asking me before about where did the Cub thing start. It literally was just my uncle bringing me to Wrigley Field when I was six. And also having watched and played a lot of baseball Sandlot, you know, that was kind of what we did all summer. And I love the game. And Wrigley, you know, WGN had, I think the Cubs had most, the broadcast more games than any other team. And they were all day games. And they were like part of your family. Ron Santo and Glenn Beckert and Randy Hunley and Jose Cardinal and Billy Williams. And I can name everybody. They were just part of your family, you know. And it's funny, I sometimes tell the story about going there the first time. We might even talk about this at Murphy's, Joe. I can't remember when we were doing the Let's Play 2 thing. But, you know, to walk into Wrigley Field and see, and I tried to remember, I was thinking, well, why was it so impactful? Like that moment in Wizard of Oz where all of a sudden it goes to color. But it was walking up the bleacher ramp and then walking, you know, hearing the mitts popping and the fungo bats going, and then walking out and seeing the greenest green, the whitest white, the bluest blue. It was like that Wizard of Oz moment. And what it was, the color TV existed. We just didn't have one. So to see all that, you know, it was like, I mean, and then Jose Cardinal right there in front of me, like right field, just right there, like it just crazy, just blew my mind. And he was like my first childhood hero. Now he's again, great, great friend. So fortunate. But he was Michelle Obama's favorite player, even though she grew up on the South Side. And so the Cub thing meant the world. And then when I was about 15 years ago, Jose invited me to this thing that they do down in Arizona called the Wrigley Randy Hunley Fantasy Camp for baseball, and you play with all the old guys and or they coach you, and then you got these teams and you learn more about baseball in a week from your idols than you'd ever known in 40 years previous. And but what I was going to say, this crazy thing happened where they had a guy called Carmen Fanzone. Carmen, this Italian, handsome, dignified Carmen Fanzone. And he was Ron. Do you know who he is, Joe?
I don't.
You don't?
No.
Wow.
No.
He was the backup to Ron Santo at third base. So he did not get a lot of playing time.
Yeah, that's like the Maytag repairman.
This went on for years. That's good. So, and it's great. And he was a horn player. He was a trumpet player, jazz musician. And it's funny because he was telling the story about he played the Star Spangled Banner in uniform on trumpet one day, right near home plate. And I thought he did it all the time. I was actually there that game as a kid. I was probably 7 or 8 when he did that. It was so interesting to know, to get to know him at this camp. And he was such a great, great guy. And he used to play. The camp is a week. On Wednesday night, he'd play at like a little jazz club. So all the campers would go and, you know, support and hang out and then get to watch him play just incredible horn, like all night long, you know, just incredible. So he comes to camp the next day and says, hey, the guy I'm playing this little combo with, there was like a keyboard player and a bass player and maybe 4 people. He said, the keyboard player said, who is that guy that, you know, people were asking to take his picture and, you know, da, da, da. He's getting kind of hassled. Who is that guy? What was that all about? And he said, oh, he's this musician and a band out of Seattle and da, da, da. And Danny, the keyboard player, his name is Danny Long. He told Carmen, he goes, I think I used to play with that guy's dad. I heard about this guy. So he told me that. Now, cut to a year later, we're back at the club Wednesday night, and they play a little set and then they take a break. And then Carmen said, "Hey, Danny would like to talk to you." And I go up and I sit behind the keyboard with him, and Danny pulls out this manila folder envelope with all these pictures of him and my dad, pictures I'd never seen. And, you know, I'd probably seen,
oh my God,
I'd probably seen less than 10 pictures of my dad. And now here there was 30, 40, you know, him in a horse and him in a tank top and him looking cool and, you know, whatever. It was crazy.
Oh my God.
So now cut to a year later, maybe two, I think I might've missed a camp, cut to a year later. And Danny brings a CD and it's got four of my dad's songs on it. I'd never heard him sing before. And I didn't listen to that thing. I didn't listen to it. I was just apprehensive. I just didn't find the right time. I didn't know when I would be in a spot to handle it. I didn't know what was on there. I didn't know. Either way, it was going to be strangely fucked up, because it was either going to be like really horrible, which would have been fucked up. It might have been really great, which might have also been fucked up, because I'd miss him or think of what could have been and whatever. So cut to, must have been 3-4 of them. I carried this little CD with me everywhere. And I was down in South America with Chris Chelios. And it was a night off, and we went and had some dinner and came back to my room. And well, we had some wine at dinner and then had some more wine at my place. And they had a good little stereo in there. And I was like, fuck it. And I wasn't alone, you know, I had some support. And we put this thing on, and it was crazy. It was four songs of this guy, and it was really good. He was good. He could really do it. And I probably could sing those songs better than I could, maybe twice as good. And it was like Wichita Lineman, Delilah, you know, like a Tom Jones thing. Mm-hmm. Wichita Lineman, he sounded great, you know. I was a lineman on the county, you know, this kind of crooner thing. Da, 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 da. He went low. And then, there's two more songs. The last one was this song about like divorce, which is what he was going through, right, for my mom. I was one when they divorced, I think. And then kept it a secret. But there's this one and he's singing and then he changes the lyrics and he says, "Would you take good care of Eddie?" And Chris Chelios, NHL Hall of Famer. He's a bruiser. He's a he-man. And we were crying like babies. It was really something. But could you imagine that coming, that happening because you love the Chicago Cubs?
Right. Mm-hmm.
And because of the camp, right, and because of Carmen Fanzone, who was like Chicago's first number 23 before Michael Jordan, before Ryan Sandberg. That's how I remembered 23 and liking 23 is Carmen Fanzone. He's still around. He works with, he's high up in the Musicians Union. I'm so grateful to him. And this guy, Danny Long, it was a crazy thing to hear your dad singing to you from the beyond.
How amazing is that he had all that still with this happenstance meeting, that he was in a position to give you all that? Does that test your, does that test your atheism at all?
Well, it makes me believe that, you know, I will remain open to things larger than our own dimension.
That's where I'm at. That's where I'm at. Religion to me is crazy. But
Eddie, while you were telling that story, you were looking up, and I'm looking at one of my best friends crying like.
That's
I don't
a
want
lot.
To say a baby crying like a man and having a really tough time hearing that.
Love you, brother.
Love you too, man. Holy fuck, dude.
Well, I'll just fill the gap by saying my sister played an interview that my dad did the year before he died with a radio host in St. Louis, and the host was asking my dad about me, and I had just started in the broadcast world, and I'd never heard the interview before, and I heard it, and it was my dad being asked about, you know, me as an announcer, and he said, "I'll tell you this right now," in his grovelly voice, "I'll tell you this right now, he's the best I've ever heard, he's better than I ever was, and most importantly, he's a nice guy, and people like him." And the host kind of questioned it, just said, "Really?" He said, "You question that?" And the host said, no, I don't." He said, "He's the best I've ever heard."
Oh, wow.
And I'd never heard my dad. He just was not that kind of dad where he'd tell my mom, he'd tell all of his friends, he'd tell the person delivering the mail, but he wouldn't tell me that. And to hear that 15 years after he died for the first time,
wow.
It's the only time I've really cried about my dad being gone, even after he died, you know, mourning him every day being in the hospital. But it was the only time that I ever really broke down. And I listened to it, and I've only listened to it once. And it's heavy.
It's such an amazing thing, though, that you got to experience that. You know, I guess it struck me just because I don't think I've ever had anything like that with my real father, you know what I mean? And being a dad is the number one thing in my life. And, you know, I'm with my boys and my girl too. And, you know, I always think of how lucky they are because they get to be so loved, and to have someone so present in their life. And, you know, I didn't really have that, you know, I mean. And I haven't had that moment really yet. And I maybe I'm like needing or looking for that moment in this reconnection with my dad. But
well, that's how that's how we started talking today, right? So you're, you know, and you were contented, but maybe you can go there. You need to go there, man.
Yeah.
Because you have the opportunity and it's an important, mm-hmm. It's an important opportunity, and you were saying that this relationship was kind of coming together because you didn't want to have regrets and mortality and all that. Mm-hmm. Well, I think it sounds like you still have a little ways to go, and mm-hmm. again, you don't want to have those regrets.
I know, and it's on me though. You know what I mean? Like I've waited for him for however. I'm 43, right? So now it's not about. It's on me to pursue it and just to keep pursuing and pursuing. You know,
and I would suggest pursue it with low expectations.
Right. Exactly. Yeah,
so it can't disappoint you any further. You know, and it's okay.
Yeah.
It's just okay.
Yeah. And I do. And. You know, but that just hit me because, you know, even from beyond, you got to hear a lyric where he's actually saying to take care of you. I mean, that's fucking gnarly. And, you know, my dad has texted me, "I'm proud of you," here and there with, you know, in our reconnection. But like, I haven't had one of those conversations, you know, with him. I mean, we had one nice, really nice moment after we drank a ton of beers and he started getting emotional because he saw so much of himself in me and you know, it was reciprocated. I was like, holy shit, this man is so much like me. Even his desire to sort of wander and to live in his studio and smoke joints and drink whiskey, and play poker and just sort of be alone. I mean, I'm a social person, but I can relate to that. And there was a lot in this long conversation through a lot of alcohol where we connected on a spiritual, you know, level, and it was awesome. But And I haven't had that sort of closure, I guess, you know, or that moment.
You know, Oliver, you know what shit, I think man. Would, you know what I think would really get him there? And I think this, you can do this, is you walk in, you know, he sees himself in you, and then that gets him. If you walk in wearing like a 1970s, like Raylon jumpsuit, orange, yellow trim,
velour.
He will.
Velour Raylon.
He will. Come on.
Exactly. Then I'll just,
Mount Vesuvius.
That's right. Dude. That's right, man. It's gonna take a wardrobe change and maybe a hairdresser to blow me out.
I'm thinking some platform, you know,
mm-hmm.
Elton John style. Mm-hmm. Like,
yes,
bring it.
That's great.
I'm gonna do that. I'm just gonna show up at his ranch in Malibu in that outfit to see what he does.
You'll be hauled off in handcuffs. That's my dad. Hey, get out of here. Well, this is the heaviest Zoom call in the history of Zoom calls. Yeah, thank you, Eddie.
Thanks for sharing that, man. That was really, just on a personal level, like a powerful thing for me to hear.
Well, Joe, that what you just said too. It's you know, I'm so happy that we've gotten to know each other over the years, and so many great experiences, and just being in contact all the time. But also watching, you know, I was watching a documentary about the '80s Cardinals, and then also there was another documentary about the Maguire Sosa thing, and so I wasn't really aware of your dad. I mean, if I had grown up in St. Louis, he would have been a fixture like Harry Carey or something. But I knew that there was some nepotism involved.
Hell yeah. Nepotism's great as long as you keep it in the family. I love nepotism. I'm a nepotite.
You're a nepotite.
Nepotite for destruction.
Yeah. Hey Ed, have you seen Battered Bastards of Baseball?
And that too. Somebody asked me, I was with
my grandfather.
A filmmaker. I just couldn't believe that is one of my all time favorite baseball movies. That is just incredible. I went and actually found some vintage 8x10s from that era. I got a little bit of a baseball connection, so I wanted those guys represented in the, and it was all Northwest, right? Was it Portland?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was Oregon, yeah.
I mean, that,
yeah.
And then Jim Boughton, I mean, come on. This is all my favorite elements of baseball aligning in one incredible kaleidoscope package. It's just incredible. If you ever, I don't know, it seems weird, sometimes you see something so powerful, you want to reach out, but right. You know, I thought about writing Kurt, and I was lucky enough to know Jim Boughton. We had some great phone calls and I read all his books and, I was lucky to get to know him. But I really wanted to pass that on to Kurt. That was just incredible. And then, it was your grandfather.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, it was Bing. Bing had the vision, you know. He had the vision, and he went and executed it. Very cool, great story, you know.
One of the best.
Just
cool and
really cool.
Yeah, just so you know, nonconformist, anti-corporate. Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
And they were crushed.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, of course. Of course.
Hey, we were talking about dads. Did you hear the Bruce story? I think he's told it somewhere. I don't think it was part of the great show at the Broadway Theater. But did you hear the Bruce one where, you know, his dad and him, they wouldn't really talk about music. And but when his dad was about to move on, I think they were in the hospital, and then I think Bruce might have asked him. See, I think Bruce had to broach the subject, and I hope I'm telling it proper in regards to my friend here, but I think the version was something like, "Dad, did you did you like any of the music? Did you like any of the music? Mm. And then his dad, I pictured him like he was grabbing his hand or something. He said, I like the songs about me. Which was, you know, Independence Day, you know, Papa, go to bed now. It's getting late. Nothing you can say is going to change anything now. Oh, my God. You know, this stuff. So, but yeah, that was, that. I think that was Bruce's moment, you know.
Mm. Mm.
Man. Shit. Well, yeah. If Pearl Jam ever breaks up, I think we should, you know, go on the road together. All three of us.
Right, and just, I'll just cry on stage. You guys tell stories about your fathers, and I'll just cry on stage.
That'll be like the thing. Like the show will be over, and they're like, it can't be over. They got to be coming out for more. And they're like, why? Well, Oliver hasn't cried yet. It's got to be the big end.
It's coming. It's coming.
They're definitely coming back out for more. Sure enough, we come out for more. Cue Oliver. Bam. Crowd agrees.
I don't get encores. Encores annoy the shit out of me. If you're going to play 15 songs, play 15 songs. If you need to be begged to come back out again, then play 13 songs.
Well, see, that's,
you know what I'm saying?
That was one of the great things outside of, you know, Pete wanting to be part of this auto-destruct art movement of the mid-60s, and then that parlaying into, you know, smashing your instruments to pieces at the end of the gig. I mean, that's the great thing, because, you know, you do that and you're not coming back out.
It's over.
That's it.
Now, I've done it where I've smashed a guitar on the last song, but it's just the one guitar. They're like, oh yeah, they're right. Definitely coming back out. You know,
you got 48 back there.
You need to smash like everything. You know, one of my favorite guitar smashing stories was Mike McCready. I think Australia '94. I think our first time down there. Or something. Mike McCready is playing soundcheck, and he's so hyped up, and he's just losing. He's playing out of his brain. You know, some solo. He's got this 1959 Strat. He's just like, you know, Jack Irons was our drummer. I think it was Jack, or maybe Dave. I can't. And we're watching, and he's just, and he fucking takes his guitar off, starts smashing like a 59 Stratocaster. It's sound check. There's no one there. Like, he was so in, like, infected, Chris Cornell says about him in the PJ20 document, infected, on fire. Just demolishes an incredible, yeah. I'll never.
It's like Animal House, like Belushi, where he smashes it against the wall. He's like, sorry.
Yeah.
Like, what did he say? That escalated fast.
Yeah.
Anybody got a guitar?
Wow.
God, that's awesome.
But infected, what it's a kind of legend word to describe that. And he's infected. I love that.
Yeah, Cornell came up with that one. That's true.
Yeah.
Man, you're the best. I don't know how to repay you. I don't know how to thank you for doing this. Who the hell wants to do somebody's podcast? But you did it, and I'm forever indebted.
My first one. There you go. Thank or God. Maybe second. Maybe second. Yeah, there you go. Yeah.
That's whatever. But you'll it was. Always be you're number sitting one on the other end of this thing. you'll be.
Thank you so much, man. You. This is good to know you too, brother. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
God, that was beautiful. Thanks, Ed.
Yeah, it was really nice.
My pleasure. I miss you guys. That was fun.
Listen to Daddy Issues on the iHeartRadio app, on Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Daddy Issues is a production of Cavalry Audio and iHeartMedia, produced by Margot Carmichael.
Sound engineering and editing by Josh Windisch.
Executive produced by Joe Bach, Oliver Hudson, Dana Brunetti, and Keegan Rosenberger.